Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, President Obama calls for all faiths to not fear one another. An expert will speak with us about religion and politics. On this Super Bowl weekend, there's a new book on anticipating terror attacks. And we'll hear about a special cafe with a dog clientele.
It's incredibly inviting, not just for the dogs, but for humans, it looks like you could eat it too.
It's right here on The Voice of America. But to begin, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry at an international donors conference in London has pledged nearly $1 billion in new U.S. aid for Syrian refugees. He also has called for the Syrian government and Russia to halt attacks on rebel-held areas in order to let humanitarian aid through. The donors conference opened today with European United Nations pledging more than $3 billion to support people in Syria, as well as in Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. Neighbor countries that are strained by the exodus of refugees fleeing the fighting by Syrian rebels, government forces, Islamic State, and others. The meeting got away hours after fragile peace talks in Geneva were suspended. Special UN envoy Staffan de Mistura, who pronounced the latest effort officially underway in Geneva Monday, suspended them Wednesday, insisting it will be a temporary pause to last not more than 3 weeks.
From the first day, I've indicated that I'm not prepared to hold talks for the sake of talks, and the Secretary General has said the same. The UN cannot allow simply procedural matters to actually become more important than actually the result for the humanitarian situation of the Syrian people who have been waiting for us to deliver, this time not a conference, but something concrete for them. I've therefore taken this decision to bring a temporary pause. Temporary pause. This is not the end, and it's not the failure of the talk.
U.S. President Barack Obama has spoken at the annual National Prayer Breakfast in Washington about how religious faith can help people embrace their common humanity.
For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. I pray that by his grace, we all find the courage to set such examples in our own lives, not just during this wonderful gathering and fellowship, not just in the public piety that we profess, but in those smaller moments, when it's difficult, when we're challenged, when we're angry, when we're confronted with someone who doesn't agree with us, when no one is watching. I pray that our differences ultimately are bridged, that the God that is in each of us comes together, and we don't divide.
President Obama's statement comes one day after he visited a mosque for the first time during his presidency. Obama told Muslims at the Islamic Society of Baltimore, "We are one American family." The president thanked Muslim Americans for helping make the country strong, but acknowledged what he had said is a hugely distorted negative view they have had to endure with the rise of terrorism-related violence by Islamist extremists. Obama said that after the terrorist attacks in Paris, France, and San Bernardino, California late last year, some people have linked terrorism with the beliefs of an entire faith. My colleague Sarah Williams joins us for more on this story.
Joining me on the line is Gary Smith. He's a historian and author of the book Religion and the Oval Office. He chairs the history department at Grove City College. Well, Professor Smith, President Obama said today at the National Prayer Breakfast that religious faith can help people overcome their fears and embrace their common humanity. Now, he was speaking the day after he visited an American mosque for the first time in his presidency. Is this call by President Obama, is this typical for an American president?
Well, presidents throughout our history have often called on American citizens to be able to express their religious faith because they've either had strong personal faith themselves or they've thought that there was a prudential value to religious faith, that it helped citizens be better citizens, it helped them be more compassionate. It helped them reach out in volunteer type of programs. It helped them deal with tragedies that they faced. So, yes, I would say that there's a long history of this.
Well, now, this is coming at a political time. Candidates for the presidency are debating the status of Muslims here in the U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump has called for Muslims to be barred from the U.S. for a while, and Ted Cruz has said the U.S. should only resettle Christian Syrian refugees. Now, Republican candidates also consider evangelical Christians to be a key part of their base. Is this consideration of religious voters, is this typical of previous presidents, or is this sort of a growing trend?
I think that this has intensified over time. We have presidents stretching all the way back to Eisenhower who've hired staff who've been religious liaisons with different religious communities, usually Protestants, Catholics, and Jews. And we've seen in recent campaigns, we've seen presidential candidates hire someone who is specifically trying to enhance their credibility and the interest of religious groups with them. So that's a pretty new development. And I suspect that we'll see that in the 2016 campaign when we get down to the final nominees. But yeah, so there's a long tradition, but it's intensifying.
And I suppose with the growth of the Muslim population in this country, it sort of makes things a bit different than before in history of the U.S.
Well, absolutely. Presidents have been reaching out to Muslims through greetings at their holiday celebrations for several presidencies now. And obviously, as America has become more religiously pluralistic, not just with Muslims, but also with people of Eastern religious practices, and then higher percentage of people who identify with no religion, presidents have to be a little bit more nuanced and inclusive in the kind of speech that they use.
My thanks to Gary Smith, author, historian, and professor at Grove City College. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
With what's going on in social media concerning this issue, I'm joined by social media reporter Andrew Palchewski. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks very much for having me. And I'll start with President Obama visiting that mosque in Baltimore, getting a lot of social media reaction from both sides of the political aisle. You have a lot of people saying, finally, it's, you know, not soon enough even, he should have gone earlier. Other people saying that they love this eighth year President Obama, some people calling it senior year Obama, you know, when you're in the last year of your classes and you kind of can lay back because you've done all this hard work, it's just waiting for graduation. So he's kind of laid back. They said that he's making these moves and doing these things like visiting a mosque. And then on the far right, you have something that a lot of very conservative people have said is that, oh, well, President Obama is a Muslim, so he's already been to a mosque. And President Obama has said multiple times he is a Christian.
Yeah, that's that plagued him his whole presidency.
It has. And so this has kind of riled up a lot of the extreme voices and social media saying that. But it's a mix of praise and some political attacks for President Obama visiting this mosque. And then, of course, we have the National Prayer Breakfast, hashtag National Prayer Breakfast, trending all through this morning, talking about how President Obama is bringing together all religions. And interestingly, you're seeing a lot of who's who in Washington, you know, congressmen, senators, people like that, that are posting on social media pictures from the event. And you notice it's Republicans, it's Democrats, it's all sides of the aisle. So for hashtag National Prayer Breakfast, the divide that you see on social media isn't necessarily political, it's more religious. So you see people of all political points on the spectrum who are people of faith and religion versus atheists who are coming out on social media and saying, why are they doing this? This isn't necessary. So you have that back and forth between those two groups on social media. But by all accounts, looking at the photos and looking at the reaction, it seems to be a positive event this morning.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew. We saw their buses going from Capitol Hill to the White House this morning, police everywhere, and it was real exciting.
That's the who's who, for sure.
Okay, thank you, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is BOA.
Here's science in a minute. To help prepare for extended spaceflight to an asteroid or perhaps Mars, the European Space Agency and NASA are planning to send a group of volunteers to bed for 60 days. According to NASA, prolonged weightlessness during space travel can cause problems such as muscle shrinkage and bone loss, and the bed rest is intended to mimic conditions that can lead to these losses. Astronauts aboard the International Space Station currently exercise for 2 hours a day to maintain their muscle and bone health. Along with keeping the volunteers in bed for 60 days, researchers at the DLR German Aerospace Center in Cologne will also put them on a centrifuge to see if artificial gravity produced by the rotating machine will offset the negative effects of weightlessness. The ESA DLR researchers conducted one 60-day bed rest study last November, but it didn't include the centrifuge tests. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Royal Dutch Shell is another casualty of the plunge in oil prices. It has confirmed 10,000 job cuts. Our senior economics correspondent Jim Randall is here in the studio to tell us what it all means, because it's very confusing. Welcome, Jim.
Hi. Shell is just one of many companies that are in deep trouble. Shell, the financial press is just jammed with stories about Shell and Exxon and Chevron and BP and the companies that support these firms, and also oil producers, Nigeria, Venezuela. Story after story after story about the plunge in oil prices has hurt the finances of these companies and these countries and the businesses that have anything to do with oil.
It's a ripple effect all the way down to the guy who sells hot dogs outside the oil plant.
Exactly. And not in the United States alone, there's one report from an analyst at Reuters who says the industry, which has 550 thereabouts people working directly for oil companies in the United States, probably by the end of this month, they will have lost 100,000 jobs, direct jobs, here in the United States alone. That doesn't count the 10,000 people at Shell who largely work elsewhere.
Well, what does that mean for the average person, though? Because this is kind of like a little tax cut for people who are buying the gasoline.
Well, yeah, when oil prices drop, gasoline prices drop, heating fuel prices drop, all kinds of prices drop, and that means there's more money in a consumer's pocket to spend on other things, food and rent and entertainment and, I don't know, a new pair of shoes for the kids.
So should we be happy or sad that oil prices are plunging?
Yes.
Thank you, Jim.
What's going on is that the oil industry is a fraction of the U.S. Economy, not a huge portion, and so their troubles ripple through the economy. But the boost that everybody else gets from spending less on energy helps the rest of the economy. So it's really a balance. If you live in Texas or you live in North Dakota, which are major oil-producing states, or you live in Alaska, another major oil-producing state, that's a big problem. If you live pretty much anywhere else, you're going to see a little bit more money in your pocket, and your paycheck's going to go a little bit further.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jim.
My pleasure.
Coming up on International Edition, concerns about security for the Super Bowl American football match, and goodies for the Bowser in your life. As fans of American football gear up for this coming weekend's 50th annual Super Bowl, police, the FBI, and other security officials are preparing for what will likely be one of the most highly guarded events ever held in the U.S. Authorities say there are no specific and credible threats against Sunday's game in San Francisco. Still, they're working to anticipate just about any type of attack terrorists might be planning. The business of imagining future terror threats also happens to be the subject of a new book authored by someone who knows the topic well, Congressman Michael McCaul, chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. International Edition's Doug Bernard recently spoke with Representative McCaul and joins us now here in the studio. Welcome, Doug.
Great to be here.
I always like to have you here. What did this fella say to you?
Well, Congressman McCaul started off right off the top by telling me that he believes the U.S. right now is, quote, in the highest threat environment since September 11th, 2001. And he was speaking across every level of society. Now, specifically with regard to the Super Bowl, the congressman said that event has been classified as a national security event. That means that it is a target for terrorists who would like to exploit that big global stage like we saw recently in Paris and Germany. But it also means that security is going to be out in record numbers. And Congressman McCaul says he does expect everything will go off without a hitch. Now, the possibility of something happening, he said, is really a perfect example of the uncertain times that we're living in.
So, in general, what sorts of future attacks does he think the U.S. might be facing?
Well, many and varied. Now, his book is titled Failures of Imagination, and you may recall that's actually a play on words from the very famous phrase used by the 9/11 Commission for how al-Qaeda could plan the September 11th attacks right under our noses and create so much damage using, frankly, little more than box cutters. So basically he's saying terror threats are always evolving, and protecting against future attacks means anticipating what they might be, not what they have been. So he highlights a number of scenarios. For example, a bioterror attack on Disney World, a effort to knock out the U.S. Congress while members are there that could throw the nation into chaos. Those are just two examples. But in one chapter titled Going Dark, he said this is the one that keeps him up at night. He describes a coordinated cyber attack that knocks U.S. financial institutions offline, as well as crippling the power grid all up and down the U.S. East Coast. And that, he said, would send the entire nation, quote, back to primitive times.
So what's he trying to do here, Doug? Is he trying to scare the daylights out of us?
Well, I think he is. And I think he's trying to do something more. It's important to remember that what he's describing aren't just scary stories cooked up by some Hollywood screenwriter. Just last month, you and I spoke about that cyber attack in Ukraine that knocked Ukraine's power grid offline. So these threats are real, even if they haven't happened yet. And what he's hoping to do is get people thinking about what these very real threats are so that they, in turn, will pressure lawmakers to actually do something about them.
The book is titled Failures of Imagination, and its author is the chair of the House Homeland Security Committee and Congress Representative Michael McCaul. Well, thank you, Doug, always.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's called the EHang 184, and it'll be the world's first passenger-ready drone. There's no pilot, just one passenger in this drone, controlled entirely through a mobile app. Two doors on either side lift out and up for entry. Its 142-horsepower engine can power the four-armed, eight-propeller craft to an altitude of 33,000 meters while cruising at 96 kilometers an hour. But so far, EHang, a China-based drone company, has not flight-tested their autonomous drone with a human on board. Actually, all we have so far is a demo video.
Early in 2013, EHang started a disruptive and revolutionary plan of making this new generation of autonomous vehicle.
The company says they'll first launch in China with an EHang 184 command center to be built in the next few months. For VOA's What's New, I'm Todd Grossman.
Love your pooch and just can't pamper him enough? Well, now there's a very special place for your pet to get gourmet food. Correspondent Deborah Block has written a web article and a video about the Dog Chef Cafe in Baltimore, Maryland, and she joins us on the line. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Susan.
Well, tell us about this place.
This is a great little place, Susan. It's located in downtown Baltimore. And even though it's called the Dog Chef Cafe, it feels more like a bakery. When you walk in, there are glass cases that are full of different types of treats and food, things like cannolis and rolls and cookies. And it's incredibly inviting, not just for the dogs, but for humans, it looks like you could eat it too.
Well, what is it made out of?
Well, actually, humans can eat it, Susan. It's made out of human-grade food, all of it. The owner of the cafe, the dog chef himself, Kevin Matthews, He is a professional chef for people, that is. And some years ago, he adopted a dog, and he didn't like the commercial dog food that was on the market. He didn't think it was very healthy or very good for dogs. So he started making his own dog food for his dog, and then pretty soon he was getting his own clients, people that were saying, you know, I don't like that dog food on the market either. I'd rather have your food. So he started to market this and eventually was able to open up this cafe.
Well, some things that you and I eat, like chocolate, are not good for dogs. How does he get around that?
Well, he actually has things that dogs can eat as well as humans. Carob, for example, that looks just like chocolate and tastes very similar to it. But dogs can eat that, but chocolate is very bad. He doesn't put things in like grapes, which are bad for dogs, but the cannoli is made with yogurt, for example, with a carob topping. And if you watch Kevin Matthews at work in the kitchen, he makes all of this from scratch. He is really a gourmet chef. It is just fantastic to watch him make these beautiful rolls and these cannolis and these cookies. And he makes them so that they're just absolutely beautiful to look at as well as to eat.
Well, what about prices?
Prices are high. I will say that. I mean, they're not so high that someone with a little bit of money who wants to treat their dog well can't afford them. But, you know, you pay for what you get.
And you get a good time for your dog.
And you get a great time for your dog. In fact, Kevin hosts birthday parties. If you want to bring your dog into the cafe, he's got a back room where you can go and have a little party for your dog. And, in fact, when I was there, there was a nice little birthday party for Pierre, a very cute white toy poodle who was there with his pet parents and some of her friends, pets and parents included. And they were back there with the beautiful dog food, some blaring music, and having a great time.
Did you see anybody actually eating the food?
I sure did. A couple of people came in, and they said to the owner, you know, that looks good enough to eat. And he said, well, it is. Why don't you try it? And one woman in particular, she was looking at one of the treats that was made out of peanut butter and looked like it was chocolate, but it was actually carob, which is safer for dogs, as I mentioned. And she took a bite out of it, and she thought it was absolutely delicious, and she finished the whole thing herself. I guess her dog wasn't going to get any of that.
Okay. Well, folks can read your article and watch your video, Dog Chef Creates Healthy Meals for Canines, at voanews.com. Thank you, Deborah, for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Thanks for joining us for International Edition.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There is a rising tide of religious persecution emerging worldwide, and it disproportionately threatens religious minority groups. This threat touches Christians in the Middle East, Yazidis in Iraq, Baha'is in Iran, Hindus in Pakistan and Bangladesh, Muslims in India, or Sunni Muslims in Shia areas, or vice versa. The threat, said Special Advisor for Religious Minorities in the Near East and South and Central Asia, Knox Thames, is clear and present. Terrorists and non-state actors such as ISIL, the Nusra Front, and Al-Qaeda are some of the worst persecutors of religious minorities. But individual attackers have also perpetrated acts of violence against religious minorities. And unfortunately, in far too many places, governments continue to limit the exercise of religious freedoms. Protecting and promoting the universal right to freedom of religion is central to American foreign policy. Not only is it the right thing to do, said Special Advisor Knox, it is a smart thing to do as it plays a major role in contributing to more stable, progressive, and dynamic societies. Wherever people face religious persecution, the United States is at work finding ways to help. For example, the U.S. pressures governments to enact reforms so that religious minorities are able to freely practice their faith. Militarily, through airstrikes, the U.S. is providing protection for minority religions to remain in their ancestral homeland. The U.S. continues to provide humanitarian assistance to Syrians and Iraqis, including refugees and displaced populations, and supports resettlement for those who cannot safely return home. The U.S. is encouraging countries in the Middle East to support, through education, respect for human rights and religious freedom. Governments in the region are also being urged to take steps to protect religious minorities during holy days and religious gatherings. The United States said President Barack Obama will continue to work with a broad coalition against those who have subjected religious minorities to unspeakable violence and persecution. All people deserve the fundamental dignity of practicing their faith free from fear, intimidation, and violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.